From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm really excited to be sharing from our book today, Abolition Feminism Now!, a book written with Angela Davis, Gina Dent, and Erica Miners, making the demand for any abolition work, including attention to feminism, and any feminism work, how essential it is to also be talking about abolition.
Abolition Feminism Now! We spend the hour with three leading abolitionist feminists, Professors Beth Ritchie, Gina Dent, and Angela Davis, who've co-written a remarkable new book out this week.
It's so exciting now to see young people especially talking about building a new world, recognizing that it's not about punishing this person and that person. It's about creating a new framework so that we do not have to depend on institutions like the police and prisons for safety and security.
We'll also speak to Angela Davis about her newly updated edition of the 1974 autobiography, edited by Toni Morrison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's launched its program to distribute free COVID-19 tests to U.S. residents by mail. Visitors to the website covidtests.gov can order 4 tests per household, which will be delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. The government will also start issuing 400 million N95 masks from the national stockpile. They'll be available for free at community health centers and pharmacies across the U.S. Some health experts say N95 masks should also be sent directly to every U.S. household. The latest efforts from the Biden administration come amidst the ongoing winter surge, with daily cases averaging over 750,000 and an average daily death toll in the United States close to 2,000. The Supreme Court rejected a bid to block a federal mask mandate on airplanes. The application was filed by a passenger who says he and his son are unable to wear masks for long periods of time due to medical conditions. In related news, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor has been listening to arguments and participating in oral arguments remotely since some of her colleagues, including fellow Justice Neil Gorsuch, reportedly refuses to wear a mask. He sits next to her. Sotomayor has diabetes, putting her at risk if she contracts COVID-19. The Omicron-fueled COVID surge is leading to record cases and tightened measures across some Asian nations. Japan's reimposing curbs on restaurants and bars starting Friday, as Tokyo reported its highest daily caseload today. In the Philippines, new data released by the government statistics office says the number of overall COVID deaths could be around 105,000, double the health department's official death toll. The Philippines reported record-breaking daily case numbers this week. In Hong Kong, authorities started confiscating small animals from pet shops after announcing it would kill some 2,000 hamsters and other small mammals after a dozen of imported hamsters tested positive for COVID-19. Indian authorities say COVID cases reached an 8-month high today, with over 280,000 new infections, though authorities say they're still a few weeks away from seeing the full impact of the current surge on hospitalizations and deaths. Meanwhile, as the world's wealthiest people gather virtually for the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization warned against persistent vaccine inequality.
If we look at the population of the world in total, over half of the world's population has received 2 doses of vaccine. But if we look at in Africa, in our African regional office states, only 7%. So the reality is that the world is moving towards a 70% goal. The problem is we are leaving huge swathes of the world behind.
The summit, usually hosted in Davos, Switzerland, is being held virtually for the second consecutive year due to the pandemic. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev today, as tensions with Russia remain high and officials warn of possible imminent military conflict. This is Secretary Blinken.
We've made very clear to Moscow that if it chooses to renew aggression against Ukraine. It will be met, and it will face very severe consequences. And again, that's coming not just from the United States, but from countries across Europe and beyond.
Blinken will meet with European officials in Berlin Thursday before holding talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva on Friday. The U.S. and other NATO members have been sounding the alarm over the Russian military buildup at its border with Ukraine, as well as the recent arrival of Russian troops in Belarus, which they say could be a launching point for a possible attack. Russia, meanwhile, has warned against Western interference and NATO's eastward expansion. Russia wants a guarantee that Ukraine will not become a part of NATO. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli forces have destroyed the home of a Palestinian family in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, just days after the Saliha family threatened to burn down their home to resist the eviction. Israeli forces raided their home early Wednesday morning while the family slept. Several members were assaulted. At least six were arrested. At least another 18 Palestinians who were at the home in solidarity with the family were also detained. The Saliha family had lived on that land since before Israel occupied the area in 1967. In related news, in the occupied West Bank, a longtime Palestinian activist has died 2 weeks after Israeli police ran him over with a tow truck during an anti-occupation protest. Suleiman al-Hafalin was 65 years old. The United Nations Tuesday condemned airstrikes by the Saudi-Emirati coalition against a Houthi target in Sana'a, Yemen, that killed some 20 people overnight Monday, including civilians. The airstrikes came hours after Houthi fighters claimed responsibility for an attack on the United Arab Emirates, which killed three people. The U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition said it launched additional air raids on Sana'a Tuesday. Analysts warned the recent attacks could represent a dangerous escalation in the ongoing war in Yemen, which has triggered what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In Somalia, at least four people have been killed and 10 others injured in a suicide bombing in the capital, Mogadishu. The armed group al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack Tuesday. The assailant walked into a tea shop located near a Turkish military installation where Somali soldiers are trained and detonated an explosive vest. This comes just 2 days after a Somali government spokesperson was injured in another suspected suicide bombing. In Mexico, the photojournalist Margarito Martinez was killed Monday in the northern Mexican border city of Tijuana. He was 49 years old. Martinez's teen daughter discovered her father near their home with a fatal gunshot wound to his head. He'd previously received threats from organized crime groups. Martinez covered police and crime for local outlets and worked as a fixer for international media, including the BBC. This is a Mexican media rights advocate.
Because of his status as a journalist, we do request that the Attorney General's office pay special attention, especially because we live in Mexico, where journalists are clearly at risk, and Margarito had requested the protection mechanism for journalists less than a month ago.
Martinez's murder came just a week after another journalist, José Luis Gamboa, was fatally stabbed in the Mexican state of Veracruz. Back in the United States, the Senate continues debate today on voting rights legislation, despite the effort being likely doomed to failure after conservative Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema said they would not back a filibuster exception to circumvent Republican opposition to voting rights. This is Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking Tuesday on the Senate floor as lawmakers open debate.
Members of this chamber were elected to debate and to vote, especially on an issue as vital to the beating heart of our democracy as voting rights. And the public is entitled to know where each senator stands on an issue as sacrosanct as defending our democracy.
The House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection issued subpoenas to four members of former President Trump's legal team Tuesday, including Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. The lawmakers said the Trump lawyers, quote, supported theories about election fraud and pushed efforts to overturn the election results. Meanwhile, the office of New York Attorney General Letitia James is seeking to question the former president, as well as Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr., saying it has significant evidence the Trump Organization repeatedly misrepresented the value of its assets for tax reasons and in order to obtain loans. Here in New York City, a vigil was held Tuesday evening for Michelle Alessago, a 40-year-old Asian-American woman who was fatally struck by an oncoming train after a man pushed her onto the subway tracks on Saturday. This is Ben Wei, founder of Asians Fighting Injustice and an organizer of last night's vigil.
This tragedy of another member of our community, the AAPI community here in New York, being taken from us is one that we've heard way too often over the past 2 years. Sadly, in New York City, in 2020, while everybody was quarantining and hate crimes across the city dropped, hate crimes against the AAPI community rose by 800%. In 2021, it rose by 350% at least.
A man, Simon Marshall, was charged with her murder. Officials say Marshall, who is unhoused, struggled with mental health issues and had harassed another woman in the subway shortly before he attacked Goh. Michelle Goh, who worked at Deloitte Consulting, was a longtime volunteer with underserved communities, including unhoused people. New Jersey public K-12 schools are now required to teach Asian American and Pacific Islander history. Democratic Governor Phil Murphy signed the law Tuesday, making New Jersey the second U.S. state to have this requirement after Illinois. In more education news, Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is pushing legislation that would prohibit public schools and private businesses from making white people feel, quote, discomfort or, quote, guilt by teaching students or training workers on racial discrimination in the U.S. This is the governor's latest attack against the teaching of critical race theory. The U.S. Justice Department's Civil Rights Division has requested Portland's police chief and city attorney hand over all Portland Police Rapid Response Team training materials following news last week the training slideshow contained a meme-like image mocking demonstrators and advocating violence against them. The image, which is believed to date from 2018 and shows a police officer in riot gear hitting a protester, came to light as part of a lawsuit around 2020's racial justice protests in Oregon. The slide also refers to the civilian being attacked as a dirty hippie. Verizon and AT&T have delayed their planned expansion of 5G cellular service near airports after a number of airlines canceled flights and warned of likely travel chaos and flight safety concerns. Airlines say the 5G technology can interfere with radar systems on planes. And a federal judge on Tuesday approved yet another adjustment to restructuring some of Puerto Rico's massive debt. The proposal was presented by Puerto Rico's U.S.-imposed financial oversight board, known as La Junta, and it reduces the biggest portion of the island's debt, about $33 billion, by some 80%. Last year, union leaders pressured the board to remove cuts to pension plans from the current version of debt restructuring deal. Opponents of the agreement say it will only worsen Puerto Rico's economic struggles. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, before we begin today's show, I wanted to ask you, Juan, about this judge's decision around Puerto Rico's bankruptcy.
Yeah, Amy, well, I haven't had a chance to parse in the details of the agreement, but I just some general comments on it. First of all, this really deals with the primarily the main government debt, which was about $33 billion, doesn't include the debt of all the other public agencies. And there it appears that the bondholders are going to get about $7 billion of that in cash, not in future debt. So it is a big payday for some of the bondholders. There will be opportunity for some of them also to get additional money in terms of a complex instrument that they call the CVI, the contingent value instrument, which basically says that if the sales taxes of Puerto Rico are above a certain level, the bondholders will also cash in billions more in the future. The main part of the agreement appears to be that the pensions of Puerto Rican workers have been saved from any major cuts. There will be no cuts to the pensions. However, future workers like teachers and judges and others in the government will now no longer have a pension. They will now have to have defined benefit. Defined contribution plans in the future. In terms of saving the workers from losing their pensions, this has been a major step forward. In terms of whether it really resolves the financial crisis of Puerto Rico going forward, that remains to be seen, because this agreement is an adjustment of a previous agreement that happened before COVID. And then, of course, COVID made the economic conditions in Puerto Rico, as in much of the rest of the country, worse. There was some victories here as a result of constant public pressure on the control board. But this control board is going to be in power. It's already been in power for more than 5 years. It will have to be in power for at least 4 years of balanced budgets before it actually leaves the island, if it ever leaves the island. But right now, there's some positives in this, but there's a lot of uncertainty still to go.
Well, we will continue to cover this as details come out. When we come back from break, abolition, feminism, now. We'll spend the hour with three leading abolitionist feminists, professors Beth Ritchie, Gina Dent, and Angela Davis. Stay with us. La Passionaria by Charlie Hayden, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, and Paul Motion. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A surge of COVID-19 cases in prisons and jails nationwide is drawing attention to dire conditions behind bars. More than 600 men at a federal prison in Mississippi, a third of the prison's population, tested positive for COVID-19 this week. Infections among people jailed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, shot up by more than 500% in the last 2 weeks. Many prisons are now locked down with visits cut off. At the massive Rikers Island jail in New York City, a group of prisoners went on hunger strike to protest their treatment during the pandemic. Most are held there because they can't afford bail and have been held for months amid court backlogs. Hunger striker Irvin Bowens describes some of the conditions that led to the protest in a voicemail recorded by his attorney.
We are currently on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week lockdown. This particular mod that we're in now, Mod 4 Lower North, we've been isolated about 15 days and counting, supposedly due to COVID protocols. As we know, the CDC guidelines states we have to be isolation for 5 days. Once we receive a COVID positive testing, we are on our 16th day currently of isolation. We are not receiving law library services. This is hindering our due process. As you can imagine, court days are currently constantly being adjourned, bail hearings and motion hearings as well. We are not receiving communication in a timely fashion as well. So we're basically here stuck in limbo.
Protests echoing the demands of the hunger strikers say the only solution is to close Rikers. Instead of moving people held there to other facilities, they're calling for the abolition of jails and prisons. This is the focus of a new book published this week by four feminist scholars and activists titled Abolition, Feminism Now. One of the authors is Angela Davis, who wrote the 2003 landmark book, Are Prisons Obsolete?, and has worked on this issue for decades, stretching back to when she herself was incarcerated as an activist in the 1970s, which she also explores in a new edition of her autobiography, also published this week. We'll talk more about that later. But first, Angela Davis joins us now, along with two of her three co-authors on this book. Angela Davis is the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Also with us in Oakland is Gina Dent, associate professor of feminist studies, history of consciousness, and legal studies at UC Santa Cruz, and an advocate for human rights and prison abolition. And in Chicago, Beth Ritchie joins us, head of the Department of Criminology, Law and Justice, and professor of Black Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her scholarly and activist work focuses on women's experience of violence and incarceration. They wrote the book with a fourth colleague, the scholar and activist Erica Miners, who has written about confronting sexual harm and ending state violence. Congratulations to you all on the publication of this new book, Abolition, Feminism Now. Professor Ritchie, we're going to begin with you. Can you talk about what an abolitionist feminist is and link that to the whole idea of what it means to be an anti-carceral feminist?
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for having us. We're super excited about the publication of this book because, in fact, what we're trying to do here is, in a very straightforward, simple, using the life experiences of activists all over the country, bring together the essential connection between feminist activism and abolitionist praxis. That is to say, we believe from our work, from our study, from our discussion with people both inside prisons and jails, detention facilities, and our work outside in communities, that it is essential to take up the questions of abolition, of policing, of prisons, of surveillance strategies. It's essential to take up that work from the perspective of feminism. And the best example that I can think of from my own work is what happens when we don't do that to criminalize survivors, that is, people who end up incarcerated or otherwise under control of the carceral state, people who experience gender violence, who turn sometimes to the state for protection, and in fact, the state turns on them. Because we know that one of the institutions that uses violence most is in fact the carceral state. So carceral feminism is the turning to that violent institution, the carceral state, to solve the problem of gender-based violence. And we realize that the result of that is more people who experience gender-based violence, in fact, detained, incarcerated, serving long sentences in U.S. correctional facilities.
And Professor Ritchie, you mentioned your own work. You have had experience teaching at a state prison in Chicago. Could you talk about how that's informed your views on this issue?
Yes, I am part of an amazing group of scholar activists, cultural workers who teach at Stateville Prison, maximum security prison, Illinois Department of Corrections. We go to Stateville in part because we believe that all people inside deserve opportunities for education. We go there week after week when we can, when there's not a lockdown. We go week after week to try to bring both the resources of our academic institutions to the students who are inside, but also we go there to learn from the students inside about what struggle means, about what freedom would look like, about what anti-carceral feminism or the possibility of abolition would mean for them and their families, what it would have meant for their lives. The book Abolition, Feminism Now really speaks to the ways that we have to learn from people inside, the way that as people on the outside, we have an obligation to bring the resources that we have, whatever they might be, in service of their freedom. Being part of the teaching collective that goes inside Stateville Prison, just like all over the country where people are going to try to bring
opportunities for education, teaching and learning, mutual, reciprocal opportunities. It's an amazing opportunity. I think Abolition Feminism Now speaks to the importance of that.
And I'd like to bring in Angela Davis as well. Angela, you've been writing about about abolition for decades. Could you talk about the importance of this book and how the climate in the country has been changing in terms of discussing this carceral state?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting us to appear on the program this morning. And yes, Juan, you're right. I have been writing about this issue along with many others. I've been an activist around these issues along with many, many others. Sometimes we feel as if we sound like a broken record. We've been talking about it for so long. But of course, this is a different era when issues of abolition have actually entered into mainstream discourse. When we began to write this book, it was before the pandemic, and we had a very different book in mind. But precisely as a consequence of the developments over the last 2 years, we think it is even more important to insist that abolitionist strategies also be feminist strategies. That we assume as broad a perspective as possible. I mean, we're not simply talking about myopically examining what is happening in jails and prisons. And of course, that's a huge issue. So I probably should not have even used that word, myopic. But we're thinking about the interconnectedness, the interrelationality between the predicament in jails and prisons and detention facilities, the violence of the police, the intimate violence that happens to so many women and gender nonconforming people all over the world. That is, as a matter of fact, the most pervasive form of violence in the world. And we want to be able to imagine a different world. We want to be able to imagine a world in which that violence has been reduced and eventually eradicated. And we think that abolition feminism is the perspective that allows us to move in that direction.
Professor Gina Dent, if you can talk about the history of abolition and feminism, and then talk about the inverse, if you will. What does it mean to be a carceral feminist?
Sure. And good morning. Thank you for having us and for paying attention to this issue in this book. Yeah, well, the history of abolition, we argue in this book, has actually been very much concerned with feminism. In fact, one of the things we try to demonstrate in the book genealogically is that we have left out in a lot of the records of contemporary abolition the feminist components. So if we're thinking about this modern abolitionist moment, which we date, as others do, from the period of Attica and then the uprising, we can think about the many different ways in which the participants who were engaged came from, obviously, communities of color, but also came from communities where women were prominent in the organizations. And that prominence disappears as we render that history into the present. And so we're really trying both to uncover that, not only to credit those who were participating, but to redress the problem of omitting those presences and those analyses and those understandings that were generated through feminism. In other words, an abolitionism that accounts for itself only through thinking about one part of the problem is not sufficient. What we're saying is that the strongest abolitionist work has been abolition feminist work. And yet we often disappear the feminist nature of that practice. We're not so much concerned with whether or not things are labeled as abolitionist or feminist. We're more concerned with documenting the practices and helping people to understand the ways that they can participate and really focusing on the problem of addressing harm and violence in our society. We're focusing, as abolitionists do, on the causes of violence and on harm, but we're simultaneously paying attention to interpersonal and state violences. And those harms are the harms that carceral feminism, or an approach to feminism which sometimes is linked to glass ceiling feminisms or other kinds of feminisms that see from above, is really a way for us to turn to the nature of feminism, which must engage with the other forms of violence. And we know, as Beth started to point out here, that feminists have often called on the state to do the work of punishment. And yet, so many people have suffered at the hands of the state, both as victims and survivors, and as those who then are incarcerated in the wake of that violence. And so we want to pay attention to both of those things. And we feel that we can't do abolitionist work without both of those things simultaneously.
I wanted to turn back to Professor Beth Ritchie. Could you concretely, for those people who cannot envision the idea of abolishing prisons, could you said that abolition is about the building of community capacity, not just about the closing of prisons. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, thank you. We spend a lot of time in the book talking about both and. And what we mean by that is it is critically important that we keep our eye on and engage in campaigns to reduce mass criminalization in this country in all of its forms. That is, reduce the number of people going into jails and prisons, release people from detention facilities, eliminate the mass spreading of things like electronic monitoring and house arrest practices, et cetera. We really need to decrease the number of people who are under the control of the criminal legal system in this country. That's an important goal. At the same time, we have to make sure that we do that in a way that keeps people safe and safe not only from incident-based violence, but safe to live their lives in their communities in ways that they choose to, where they have opportunity, where they can create relationships, where they're free to move without worry in the public space that they occupy. And we have to make sure that we are addressing the root causes of the incarcerations and the violences, so that we're building a world where people are free, the kind of opportunity that I just talked about, where people can move in their space, can raise their children, can get an education, can afford their housing. So we use the both and metaphor in the book to talk about, yes, campaigns to close Rikers, campaigns to eliminate cash bail, and work that is looking much more at the root causes of suffering and pain and harm and violences, so that we don't ever have to rely on those kinds of systems, not that they work anyway, but never have to rely on those kinds of systems as if they bring safety and freedom and opportunity. So we're really not, we are indeed talking about decarceration, but we're also talking about building opportunities for freedom. And that's what a feminist analysis brings to the project of abolition. And indeed, feminists who are looking to create freedom and opportunity, not just safety from harm, have to be engaged in some of these abolitionist struggles.
You know, the pandemic has been a kind of X-ray on inequality in the world. And we certainly see that when it comes to the prisons. We began the segment by talking about the surge in COVID cases in prisons and jails around the country. And we played a clip of a hunger striker right now inside Rikers, where many are protesting the conditions that have been worsened under the pandemic. You have at the massive Rikers jail facility, The call now for by the city and the state to build other jails and other in the boroughs to shut down Rikers. But the abolitionists are saying we don't want other jails built. If you can respond to that, Professor Ritchie.
Yeah, I want to also say when you were playing that clip and the discussion about what a lockdown means, what an abolition feminist analysis allows us to do is also understand that the widespread policy of lockdown, both inside facilities and in the community, leaves people at risk. So in the world of gender-based violence, for example, a lockdown, having to stay at home, having to cut off contact with community who might offer support. You see, there's a parallel danger that's created when we lock down inside, of course, but also when we lock down in community for those people where home is not safe. So a stay-at-home policy to create safety doesn't work for people who experience gender-based violence in their homes, right? I just want to make that point. And that's what an abolition feminist analysis allows us to do, make those connections. In terms of what I call the movement of a prison nation ideology from one jail to another jail, to a maximum facility, to house arrest, to use electronic monitoring, to build community-based jails, to do gender-specific or sensitive programs inside. All of the efforts that are under the guise of reform that allow somehow people to believe that a kinder, gentler space of incarceration is a better place, distract us from the real goal of abolition. That is to say, moving people out of one space of confinement into another space of confinement is what we call in abolitionist work reformist reform. That is, it doesn't do anything to set people free. And that needs to be our goal. That always needs to be our goal, to figure out where we can open up the opportunity for liberation, not replace one system of domination and control with another. And that, I think, is what the critique is on the ground.
Your book also addresses the issue of abolition, not just within the context of the United States, but in an international framework. I'm wondering, Gina Dent, if you could talk about some of the abolition strategies that you look at in terms in other countries as well.
Yes, well, fortunately, this work has always been international. When we think about even the campaign to free Angela, its internationalist component was so key to her freedom today. And we wanted to make sure to build on the work that we've been able to be exposed to all of these decades with people in other parts of the world who have come to the same conclusions. That the spread of the global capitalist relationship to the prison industrial complex is not something that anyone can and should support, that the development of supposedly nicer, more modern jails and prisons is not a mark of the increasing fairness of society. And so we draw on campaigns in South Africa, in Brazil, in Australia, in the UK, where people have been coming to similar conclusions. But we try to lift up especially the work that has been feminist and has been responsive both to domestic violence and other forms of gendered harm, but has also been engaged with feminist practice in thinking about those issues. And we are sensitive to the fact that in many places around the world, we are often asked to speak about abolition as if it comes only from inside of the U.S. But we've, of course, been inspired throughout our work together by organizations like Sisters Inside in Brisbane, Australia, Sisters Uncut in the U.K. And these organizations do, in the case of Sisters Inside in Australia, service work for people who are currently incarcerated and recently released, but they also do legal work. They also do work to support people as they are freed, because build on what Beth already established, we do want people out of prison, but they also need to get services that allow them to stay in the free world, because many of the reasons why people are in prison in the first place is because of what they did not have access to. And so we've been inspired, especially by work in Australia, by the fact that there's a possibility to work across the prison walls. Sisters Inside has been a model because it has been able to have people on its governing board who are serving time along with people who are in the free world. And that kind of work is inspiring because it's something that has been almost impossible to achieve, for example, in the United States. We're also documenting the work of Sisters Uncut in the UK. They have been incredibly active in doing work to talk about the problem of a society removing funding and defunding so many of the things that people need. And instead, they want us to defund in criminalization, defund in incarceration, and defund in the systems that are not attending to and not enabling us to improve our society.
You know, I'm wondering, as we look at the two of you at home, the pandemic, you know, gives a kind of lens on the world that's very different right now. If you could comment on, the two of you are longtime partners, Gina Dent and Angela Davis. What was it like? Is this your first book together? And what was it like to write it under pandemic conditions?
Do you want to take that?
Well, let me point out that the idea for the book came from Erica and Beth. They had been talking about the possibility of such a book for a while, and they presented us with the opportunity to join this collective. However, it was before the pandemic started. So we imagine ourselves meeting in Chicago, inviting the two of them to Northern California and spending time working together in that way. And then, of course, the pandemic hit. And our communication has been entirely over Zoom. We have not seen them in person since we actually began seriously to work on this book. The pandemic also meant that the book would have to address different dynamics. We witnessed the entrance of abolition into mainstream discourse in a way we had never imagined to actually experience ourselves. And let me say that now that the mass mobilizations have died down, people are thinking perhaps about what might be the lasting impact of this moment, this particular historical conjuncture. We feel that the ideas that we offer in this book will be helpful to the process of bringing about a radical change. And let me make the point that we all see the feminism the feminist practice, the feminist theory as an anti-racist and anti-capitalist international feminism. We hope that it will help people to think a bit more deeply and a bit more expansively about the possibilities of a future without police, without jails and prisons, and a future without the kind of pandemic violence that we are currently experiencing.
Well, we want to thank...
I wanted to...
Go ahead, Juan.
Oh, and I just wanted to ask Professor Beth Ritchie about the all four of you were active in Critical Resistance, the organization that began to bring abolition into the public light in the 1990s. For those younger viewers and listeners or others who may not know about Critical Resistance, could you talk about it and its significance?
Critical resistance was amazingly significant, still is, as the national organization really comprised of activists both inside and outside who demand that abolition is possible. It's not only possible, it is our way to freedom. And it has a long history, much of it we chronicle in the book, of making sure that we keep our focus on root causes of mass criminalization, that we see a hope and a joy in the possibility of abolition. It helps to sort of name things like the prison industrial complex. It brought together people from all over the country, multi-generational, people from different ethnicities, different countries, led by women, many women of color, visibility of queer people, to say that we are going to unite as a national movement to end the tyranny of mass criminalization in this country. Importantly, in the book, we link the history of critical resistance with the history of another major organization in this country in terms of shaping our analysis of freedom, which is Insight. And there's this is one of the first places where Insight, which is an organization that came together to name and resist state violence as a form of gender violence, that critical resistance and Insight as an abolitionist and a radical feminist organization comes together, and we talk about how that happens and how that shapes the work of abolition feminism now.
Well, we want to thank you all for being with us. Abolition Feminism Now, by Angela Davis, Gina Dent, and Beth Ritchie. Erica Miners is the fourth author of this book. Angela Davis, the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and distinguished professor emerita at University of California, Santa Cruz. Gina Dent, associate professor of feminist studies, history of consciousness, and legal studies at UC Santa Cruz. And Beth Ritchie, head of the Department of Criminology and Justice and professor of Black Studies at the University of Illinois. When we come back, we'll talk to Angela Davis about a second book, the newly updated edition of her 1974 autobiography, edited by Toni Morrison. Stay with us.
Sisters,
I've been waiting quite a while. I ain't asking for a piece of yours. I only want what's mine. I apologize if I arrive at an inconvenient time. My attitude unravels you, then pay me some mind. I ain't waiting for the world to change. To paint the world a serving game. Gonna give it to my kids, not as it is, but as it should be. We the agitators, the movers and shakers. Flipping out if you ain't got my dough after the show like I'm the baker. I ain't no savior. Turn up the faders. It's just me and you like elevators. No matter haters. It's not now. The way they told me, he'll tell me later. Time is of the essence and ain't nothing fair about the favor. The movement all been moved out the way. They told me wait until tomorrow, that was the day. It's divine feminine, that rhythm in the small of your back. Restoring the balance, not just respond and react.
If Not Now, Terry Lynn Carrington and Social Science featuring Maimouna Youssef. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue our conversation with the legendary activist and academic Angela Davis, she has two new books out this week, Abolition Feminism Now!, which she co-authored, and a new edition of her autobiography, which was first published and edited by Toni Morrison in 1974. The book details Angela Davis's early life, from growing up in a section of Birmingham, Alabama, known as Dynamite Hill due to the frequency of bombings by the Ku Klux Klan, to her work with the Black Panther Party and the U.S. Communist Party. In 1970, the FBI named Angela Davis as one of the 10 most wanted fugitives. Once caught, she faced the death penalty in California. After being acquitted on all charges, she spent her life fighting to change the criminal justice system. Angela Davis, before we ask you about this new edition of your autobiography, we want to go back over half a century to an interview you did from jail after you were arrested in 1970.
There came a point where the revolutionary forces at work in the black community began to express themselves in jails and prisons. However, unlike, say, the campuses, unlike any other area in the society, even the armed forces, the room for any kind of meaningful political activity is so narrow that obviously as soon as the prison officials became aware of what was happening, they would confront these new developments with the most devastating kind of repression imaginable. And this is why, when I was involved in all of the problems at UCLA surrounding my membership in the Communist Party, and when I was fighting for my job, I had just become aware of what was happening in the prisons, and I always insisted that people who were supporting me in my fight to retain my job, regardless of what my political beliefs and political activities were, had to look at the prisons.
So that was Angela Davis speaking from jail in 1970. Angela, in your new introduction to the updated edition of the book, you write, "When I decided to write the book after all, it was because I had come to envision it as a political autobiography that emphasized the people, the events, and the forces in my life that propelled me to my present commitment." It was the late, great writer Toni Morrison who pushed you to do this. Can you talk about what the vision you had together? I mean, you were in your 20s writing an autobiography.
Yeah, I think that when Toni Morrison first raised the possibility of my writing an autobiography, I laughed because it seemed that it was almost ridiculous to consider writing an autobiography in my 20s. However, we both came to the conclusion that it might be possible to write the kind of book that would be meaningful, that would not focus on me individually, but would rather be more of a political autobiography. And I'm so thankful to Toni now that she managed to convince me to write this book. Not only because it helps to provide a historical record for the struggles that unfolded 50 years ago, but also because it allowed me to link the writing of this autobiography to other collective undertakings, such as the slave narrative.
And Angela, I wanted to talk to you about this. You were, in essence, incubated or a product of what many call the old left, the Communist Party USA, but then moved more into the Black Panther Party and what would be called, I guess, the new left of the radical revolutionaries within the African American community. Could you talk about that change in your life and the impact that the Panther Party had at that time in the African American community? I recall back then a report coming out that the FBI had done a poll and found that over a quarter of all African Americans were supportive of the Black Panther Party at the time, and J. Edgar Hoover was almost catatonic about that.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would characterize my development as a move away from, what is referred to as the old left and, you know, toward formations such as the Black Panther Party. I sort of grew up with the Communist Party as a part of my coming of age experience. My mother and father had very close friends who were Black leaders in the Communist Party. And I'm thankful for that experience of recognizing how important it was and continues to be to situate struggles for Black liberation within a larger international framework. You know, we talked about the internationalism of the of the book we just published together, Abolition Feminism Now. And I'm thankful for the internationalism that helped me to recognize how important it was to link Black struggles to struggles of the working class in this country and struggles for African liberation, struggles unfolding in Latin America. And so I don't know whether I moved from one point to another, but rather attempted to find points of connection and interconnections among the various perspectives.
Angela, as you updated your autobiography and wrote a new introduction, what struck you most as you reflect on your life now, what almost half a century later, writing that autobiography in your 20s?
Well, first of all, I realized I could not update it. And in rereading it, revisiting it, I always expressed a sense of relief that I had actually written the book in my 20s, because I don't know whether I would be able to write such a book today. What struck me was how much has changed, both how much has changed and how little has changed. And of course, my first impulse was to, revise those expressions and those ways of thinking and knowing that made me almost cringe in rereading the book. By the way, I narrated the autobiography for an audio book, so I literally had to read every single word aloud. There were things, of course, I would have wanted to change, and I indicate this in the preface. But then it became apparent to me that I was also providing a record of how our struggles over time had shaped the ways we think about issues. I point out, for example, that initially the language that I used to describe what was happening in women's prisons was very homophobic, and I was a product of my time. And it is very inspiring to recognize how far we have come. Not only in the way we talk about sexuality, but the way we talk about gender and the way we are constantly challenging binary notions of gender. And all of these transformations have happened as a consequence of the fact that people have dedicated themselves to struggle for an end to racism, to imperialism, to war, an end to misogyny. And let me say that in rereading that text,
we have 20 seconds.
I became aware of the absolute importance of anti-racist, anti-capitalist, abolitionist feminism.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Angela Y. Davis, a world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Two new books out this week, an updated edition of her autobiography. It's called Angela Davis, an Autobiography, and Abolition, Feminism, Now. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.